This morning I was thinking about the great deaths in literature and the arts. What is the greatest death in literature? Not necessarily the greatest performance of the death itself, but a death of a life well lived, a death that validates and puts a stamp on all that came before. Hamlet came to mind, Achilles, Darth Vader, Stringer Bell in The Wire, Madame Bovary. And I was trying to do this exercise because I was struggling to think of a literary death better than Moses's. With all of its grandeur and flaws, and all of his grandiosity and flaws, and humility and delights, nothing became Moses like the leaving of the world. It's such a striking image of the patriarch, the hero of a saga, to remain outside his goal, in sight of the promised land, and to die there. And I've always struggled, and candidly, so have the Midrashim, so have the sages, with why the Torah ends that way. Why his life ends so tantalizingly close. But it, as hard as it is, the joke in TV writing, as hard as it is to end a good series, or even a good novel for that matter, no one stuck the landing like Moses. It's really just so poetic. And David Mamet, the playwright, thought about this, though he went in a different direction. Moses is told that he may not enter the promised land because of what would seem a trifling incident at the well of Meribah, that is, hitting the rock. But may we not see his exclusion as a blessing? He was, we are told, a faithful servant. How wonderful for him, then, to be given rest in sight of the goal, but spared from the quotidian, the enervating, the anguishing results attendant upon work's completion. Any triumph, any absolute end, says Mamet, must be followed by a period of emptiness, loss, dejection, and self-doubt. Had God informed Moses, "You have performed perfectly, now enter to receive your reward," Moses would have had no reward at all. I agree with David Mamet, one of my favorite playwrights, that Moses' death is very precise and very precisely realized in a most beautiful literary form. But I think Mamet has it all wrong about why it's a good death. And to explain that to you, I want to refer to one of my, a book I really treasured this year called The Second Mountain by David Brooks. Came out about 3 months ago. I first saw it on an Aspen lecture, which you get the sense of the book from the Aspen lecture itself. Conceptually, it's this. I'm going to elaborate and flesh it out as we go. That the first mountain in a human life is career, resume, the facts and details of one's experience and achievement. And at some point, maybe by divorce, depression, addiction, catastrophe, trauma, difficulty, one comes off that mountain and realizes it wasn't so great and falls into a valley, a period of soul searching, and then finds his or her way up, with luck, to what Brooks calls the second mountain, the mountain of a different kind of generativity, what Erickson would have called generativity. So I want to talk about that primarily through the lens of Moses' life. Moses' life doesn't have a perfect two-mountain structure, but it follows some of the curves very nicely. So the Ravaz, who was probably Bezalel Zev Shafran from Romania, writing in the 1800s, noted that one's name is not determined by the events of one's life, but by one's actions. I think what he's saying is that we are more than our resume. But clearly in his early life, Moses was something of a resume. He was the princely son. He was the leader of a new tribe. He received revelation. He became a priest in Midian. He built achievements. He found things to do, things to occupy himself with that made him, if not haughty, gave him a certain social stature. That's what Brooks would probably call the first mountain. But something happens. Now, in the narrative of Moses, it's not so clear what knocks Moses off the mountain. But there is certainly a transition in his life where he's given the new task of leading a stiff-necked people. And he's entrusted with a new task that takes him out of the upper echelons of power and makes him an outcast both among the Israelites and among the Egyptians, that pushes him to the outskirts of society and frankly, the pain that must entail. And Brooks, David Brooks, talks about this valley period, this period of soul searching. We don't have much of Moses' soul searching, save that he took some time in Midian to recognize that a bush was on fire but not consumed, which is not as simple as it looks. Do you know how long it takes to recognize that a bush or a log is on fire but not being consumed? Do you know how long you'd have to look at one of the logs in your fireplace to sense whether or not it was turning to ash? Typically, it takes about 8 to 20 minutes to be certain that the log is changing. And he's in some sort of fallow period in his life, something we might call a valley, something the 23rd Psalm calls the Gates al Mavet, the valley in the shadow of death, the psalm that we read at every funeral. And he must have struggled to understand where his life was taking him. Coming down off the heights of Egyptian society, coming down eventually off the heights of Mount Sinai, where he was entrusted and became the most senior of God's prophets, where he has roles and stature and status and action. And at some point, I think we all come to this point that the resume feels a little shallow. That it's not enough to be a physician. What we really dream about is being a mason or a gardener. That it's not enough to have achieved senior vice president, executive vice president, president of a company. There's got to be something more. Perhaps we understood our marriage to be infallible, perfect, pristine, a sense of our worth in life, and the marriage dissolves. Perhaps we trust in our vigor. We've been competitive athletes, and our ankle or hip gives out. About to enter a ballet company and we receive bone spurs. That the life we imagined ourselves to lead either is detoured or we just recognize that it's not all it was cracked up to be. I rode my bicycle cross country with three friends after college. And we usually would plan to stay in campgrounds or with people we'd meet, people we planned to meet along the way, or people who had offered assistance to cyclists. And one day we were in Minnesota and a thunderstorm broke out and we were shivering and we pulled into a country store. And I can't remember if the husband or wife said, "Oh, you look awful. Why don't you come stay at our place?" Turned out he was a concert pianist and she had been the vice president of Pac Bell. Back when there was I don't think there still is a Pac Bell. Right? Senior vice president, executive vice president of Pac Bell. And I asked her, you know, I'm 22 and starting my career potentially going into the Peace Corps. I asked her, "What's that like?" And she says, "Well, this is a weird metaphor, but it works. It's like you have a pot of warm oatmeal and you're stirring it with your hand. You put your hand in and it feels kind of nice and comfortable and good. And then you take it out and all you have is crud on your hands. At some point, that's the valley. That what we thought mattered, somehow the strata, the scaffolding around all of that breaks and we see not so great. And we are in the gates al mabit. We are in the valley of death's shadow. And as Leonard Cohen says, we strive, we reach out. I greet you from the other side of sorrow and despair with a love so vast and shattered, it will reach you anywhere. Elsewhere, ring the bells that can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Sometimes, I don't wish character building experiences on any of you, but they're gonna come. And sometimes we find ourselves shattered. Maybe we're 25, maybe we're 75. Maybe the life we were living changes dramatically through illness, death, travel. We get fired. Getting fired can sometimes be the best experience of a person's life. And we strive, we struggle, we're looking for the thing that's next that could orient ourselves. As the scholar Joseph Campbell says, we have to be willing to get rid of the life we've planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us. And so we turn from this vision that may have been illusory, that may have been not all it was cracked up to be, that may not be the thing we thought it was or the thing we thought we needed or wanted. Moses leaves the palace, goes out into the wilderness, reaches Sinai, begins to turn his life over to greater forces, striving and seeking throughout the book of Exodus and into the book of Numbers for something greater than himself, for new meaning, for a relief from the ennui and the lack of understanding of his role in the world. And so we find ourselves in the valley in prayer. Not necessarily Jewish prayer, not necessarily vocal prayer, but desperate in prayer, in need of a new direction. And we turn ourselves to the world greater than us. We orient ourselves past our own shortcomings, past our own limits, and try to understand ourselves anew as part of a microcosm, as a piece of a larger world, a particle within God. Abraham Isaac Cook, the first rabbi of Mandatory Palestine, said that if a person should seek for themselves less than a life oriented toward God, they will at once become like a ship tossed about at sea. Stormy waves will eventually rob them of peace. If he or she should be able to immerse themselves in some preoccupation, they may succeed for a time, and it will seem like they found peace. But it will not take long, and the spirit will finally break out of its imprisonment, and the maddening agitation will begin to act in all its fury. The place we may find peace is only in God. That sense of being in the eye of a hurricane, that sense of being bereft and unmoored and confused and distracting ourselves with love and television and YouTube and alcohol only lasts so long, and we realize our soul craves something much more profound. And this is when, if we're lucky, we catch sight of the second mountain. And this is, I think, the latter half of Moses' career. Moses' career in wilderness can be described, ironically enough, as his mountain, his second mountain. The life of Second Mountain, says David Brooks, is a life of community and faith and family and connection. It's a life that transcends achievements, bullet points, dots on a resume, and goes towards generativity, the crisis that Erickson described as leaving our mark, creating something that endures. Often this comes in the simplest forms. Brooks talks about people who went on to start NGOs, people who took stray children into their home for dinners every week, people who gave back to their communities, and in small and large ways, people like Brooks who became engaged in a religious community. That's what matters in the end, in Brooks's experience, and frankly in mine. Not in my personal life yet, but in the experience of you. What really matters is the connections you build, the web you build, the richness of a life of loyalties and connection. Seneca, the Roman writer in the first century, said that the duty of a man is to be useful to his fellow men. If possible, to be useful to many. Failing this, to be useful to a few. Failing this, to be useful to his neighbors, and failing them to himself. For when he helps others, he advances the general interests of humankind. A life of service, a life of usefulness, a life of willingness is the life that's waiting for us on the second mountain. And what's interesting is I look around the room, I'm looking at people who I think have found their second mountain. And I'm looking at people who are young and already on a second mountain. And I guess what Brooks doesn't really give voice to is that it's not just two. It's a constant renewal and a constant reinvention of finding newer and deeper and more rich ways, more thick ways to connect to your community, to your faith, to your family, to your nation, to your polity. Chaim Ozer Grodzinski was the author of the Achiezer, a well-regarded Torah commentary in the early part of the 20th century. He died, I think, shortly before the Shoah in Lithuania. But he experienced, of course, the years of penury that preceded the war. And he is said to have said that for years I thought my ticket to the world to come, the heavenly abodes, would be the Achiezer, which is the book he wrote. Now that I'm getting on in years, however, I believe that what stands in my favor is that I took responsibility for widows and orphans throughout Europe. All this writing and checks and bills, resumes, pocketbooks, it's important. It matters. It's real. But the true life of the Spirit is lived somewhere else. The true life of the Spirit of a business person is probably the person you help to start a project, not just the receipts. The true life of the Spirit of a teacher is not the paycheck or the lesson plan, but a student reached. The true life of the Spirit, the second mountain for a father, might not be his or her career at a bank, but might be the moments of watching his children ride a bike or go to college or stand on their own 2 feet against a bully. Dennis Lehane, in his one of his murder mysteries, writes, the narrator says, "I love the things that chafe, the things that fill me with stress so total, I can't remember when a block of it didn't rest on top of my heart. I love what, if broken, can't be repaired, what, if lost, can't be replaced. I love my burdens." I think that's what happens to Moses. I think it's possible, again, I've said, pointed out before, and this is a scholarly presentation, that the Bible doesn't tell us enough detail to be certain of things. That's where Midrash comes in. The Bible foregrounds most and doesn't have much of the background to read. I think it's possible that Moses was a callow youth until whatever age, was called to service, struggled with that, desired to be proud and significant in the life of Israel, but towards the end of his life was clearly spending time building communities, giving instruction and law. He's known as our teacher and lawgiver, not our master. It happens to everyone, right? Like I don't want anyone to feel bad that happens. It happens. But what he was really known for in the Jewish tradition is giving the rudiments, the rubrics, and the ligaments of a community, the things that would build a people together, the laws that would allow us to live together. That's what mattered in his life in the end, is that he was a teacher and a lawgiver, not that he was a prince, not that he was successful by any sort of metric of finance or riches or regard, but that he had a legacy. Philosopher and author Michael Sandel says that we can't regard ourselves as independent without understanding ourselves as the particular persons we are, as members of a family or this community or this nation or this people, as bearers of this history, as sons and daughters of that revolution, as citizens of this republic. To imagine a person incapable of constitutive attachments such as these is not to conceive an ideally free and rational agent, but to imagine a person wholly without character and without moral depth. That's what Brooks is saying. Part of his argument, in a way, is a rejection of individualism, and to an extent of laissez-faire atomistic capitalism. That what you do as a person isn't enough. What Moses did as a person isn't enough. His legacy was Israel, not any particular mountain where he received word of God. He was buried on Har Nebo, on a mountain that we scarcely can identify, in a place that no one knows. What mattered was what he left behind, the legacy of a people enshrined in books and connections and communities, connected by ligaments of law and teaching and lore and love. Like Moses, like Abraham Cook, the rabbi of Mandatory Palestine, or even Herzl, who never saw the fulfillment of the Zionist dream, like King, who never saw the true restitution of racial and other justice, we never get there. We're always striving, we're always climbing a mountain. If we're lucky, we've been through valleys and seen new mountains that will connect us and embed us and enrich us. But we never get to the top and stop. I'll leave you with the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Could have been Moses speaking. I just want to do God's will. This is, I think, days before he was murdered. I just want to do God's will, and he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. I've looked over. I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.